Bernie Sanders had like an identity crisis, comes out, new man. Anyways.
Yeah, no, but that's it. And
big tinfoil on his head, sorry.
And then, like, the little antenna coming out.
He becomes Vermin Supreme.
Welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Molly Radwell. I am honored to be here, hosted by Megan, Franz, and Zach. It is a beautiful day out, 84 degrees, clear skies. Speaking of skies, if we extend outward from there, we're going to be talking about space today. Space weaponization, pros, cons, benefits. Zach, do you want to tell us a bit about what space weaponization is?
Absolutely. So, first of all, casual conversations. The Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, what we normally aim to do is we want to interview professors, we want to interview graduate students, people who really have subject matter expertise. Casual conversations is a little bit different. None of us are experts on space weaponization, and none of us claim to be, but we all do take, or most of us, three out of four of us, take a class, regarding space weaponization. So we thought it'd be cool if we just have a casual conversation, we talk about it. So we can still inform viewers about things we do know, but we're not setting, you know, in stone clear policies or talking about things that actually, you know, have happened in the world, right? So don't quote us on anything, but you will learn and it'll be fun. And that's the point of casual conversation. So welcome to the very first episode. Space weaponization. Franz, what is it?
Okay, so it's essentially the ability of one state or like a country to be able to put weapons in space in such a fashion that they can shut down or interfere with another country's satellites, which in today's world, all of our modern weapons or advanced modern weaponry rely on satellite, help to function. So if you take out the satellites, then their conventional weapons on Earth also falter.
Right, like Trump literally, you know, a week ago, or earlier this week, Trump tweeted about how we have smart and, like, nice bombs, like, quote-unquote smart, nice bombs. He's referring to the fact that our bombs are literally GPS-guided. You know, we don't just drop them now. We drop them and they will rocket-propel themselves to their exact location, and none of that would be possible without satellites in space, right, specifically targeting, you know, where they're going to go. So that's why military capabilities of developed countries now completely rely on space, specifically satellites.
So, therefore, you can see why space weaponization, you know, it's a risk. Does the United States go to become a hegemon in space and then control space, protect all of our satellites, prevent other countries from, you know, being able to damage our satellites? Or would that provoke, you know, some sort of arms race?
Imagine if we have a monopoly on, like, satellites. So we're the only country with a satellite, and all the other countries have to ask for our permission to use the satellites.
You don't even have to imagine.
Like, this happened. This was the Soviet Union, 1957. They're the only country with a satellite, and they were able to use it as their advantage, and it sparked the space race. I mean, this is what started it all, which caused, you know, eventually humans reaching the moon, which is insane. But it's all because of military competition, or, you know, in part because of military competition. We thought if the Soviet Union can use space technology, we want to be able to use the same thing, stuff like that.
And we learned a lot from that. We gained a lot of new technology. Like we said, we reached the moon, but is that like a best case scenario where we learned all this stuff? It was, you know, competition, not friendly, but it turned out okay. Or, you know, if we did it again, could it result in a less good scenario?
I think that that's definitely the case, because now it's not a bipolar world. Now it's not the United States versus Russia or the Soviet Union back then. It's now the United States and Russia and China and the European Union, right, and India and everyone else.
The European Space Agency and all these people. So essentially where we're at is you have these satellites in space, and developed countries militarily rely on space. You cannot have a war, or you would be severely disadvantaged without space technology, at least in the modern age. The problem is these satellites are just floating around Earth or orbiting around Earth 23,000 miles away, right? They're just in a complete orbit. It's called geosynchronous orbit, and there's nothing protecting them. There's literally nothing stopping a country just shooting a missile at one of these satellites and just completely destroying our infrastructure.
I also think an important thing to note about satellites is they don't just have military uses. They're highly integrated with a lot of regular civilian activities. For example, GPS system.
The weather.
Exactly. Yeah. Weather satellites monitoring, GPS navigational systems. Those are all integrated and also founded in the information we receive and send from satellites. And so attacking one of those would have economic and other implications.
Television. Uber would be done for.
Going back to weather, like, imagine, like, on April Fool's, like the sickest prank someone could pull on another country is just interfere with their weather satellites and just say like, oh, tornadoes in the entire country.
Yeah, just like...
like accidentally sending some type of like notification of a, I don't know.
An Amber Alert, yeah. Like flooding everywhere.
Three tornadoes per square foot. Cry about it.
Yeah, so anyways, here's April Fool's. An interesting thing is the way satellites are actually set up currently is it's... there are like essentially different satellite rings. So it's not like the U.S. doesn't have specific, the U.S. does have some military satellites, but in terms of commercial satellites, there are really three main conglomerates. One is this conglomerate called Intelsat, which is really interesting. It's like this privatized business, which literally has their own satellites, and then countries will pay Intelsat for usage of those satellites. So it's like a lease or a loan. You like pay for usage. It's like, you know, us buying bandwidth for Wi-Fi or internet is the same thing as countries buying bandwidth for satellites in space, which is kind of interesting. That's a commercial side. There's also military satellites. But
oh, this is maybe a personal thought, but I don't like the idea of the private sector in space.
Me neither. That bothers me so much.
I think we should treat space as a utility that needs to be regulated.
Okay, well, this is coming from the guy who's going to argue that we should become a hegemon in space. So continue.
Yes, I mean, it's in the same line of thought.
Oh, I go opposite round. Look ahead. You
because
first.
Here's the thing. So... if we have private corporations, they could, in theory, do deals. Even if it's an American private corporation, they could, in theory, do deals with Russia. They could, in theory, do deals with China. And if a conflict happens, that could put our national security at risk.
So, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm an international studies and sociology major. And when Zach is talking about 3/4 of us being in this global security politics class, I'm the 1/4 that is not.
Lame.
And so from my sociology perspective, we're talking about the private sector in space. That could be interpreted as the next phase of global capitalism where transnational corporations supersede the states as the main actors. So you might see that today in, you know, regulating global trade and who's the real benefit from who's the real benefactor of globalization. Maybe that's the transnational corporations.
Right.
So then that stands to, you know, we have to consider if we, you know, protect space, who are we protecting it for? Are we protecting it for the people or for the transnational corporations? And who's going to win?
I would argue that we're protecting it for our national security.
Our as in a U.S.-centric perspective?
Or if we're operating... human society. Now, let's say that we're having this conversation in, like, China. China would say, oh, we're protecting it from our national security.
Yeah.
But, like, the countries should be protecting space to ensure their national security. It's not beholden to private corporations.
What if you want to protect the security of the human species as a whole? Is that a... security,
well,
that can transcend
Molly,
boundaries.
Are you assuming that we're going to face an alien invasion? Which, if you guys go back to the first podcast, we discussed that.
Well, what
oh,
remember,
you're right.
But because all the, like, the satellites are also civilian usage, so everyone uses the same satellites for GPS, everyone uses the same satellites for communication. What Molly's saying is, instead of just thinking of in a U.S.-centric way, like, let's protect our military satellites, maybe we have some organization that will protect the commercial side so everyone has access to satellites, right?
I think space is a utility, and it has a lot to offer and a lot of resources, and exploration of it shouldn't be limited or hindered because we're afraid of it being weaponized. But I think that then we have to approach it in a way that's going to distribute any benefits we gain from space in an equitable way that will benefit everyone on Earth. Because if you open up to a private sector, that's just going to increase the exploitation of anything we find in space and the privatization
right.
of that.
Like,
but now we get into the tricky subject of international organizations actually regulating stuff efficiently.
Oh, God.
So maybe there's not a good precedent for that. All
right, let's back up.
Okay.
All right, so we've talked about what satellites are, what their purpose is, and why we need them. And we made a very vague comment about attacking satellites, but let's talk about the structure about actually international regimes in space. Are we allowed to build space weapons in the first place? Is it feasible? Do we want to?
I would just like to say that space weapons also don't have to be something that attacks satellites. We've had different discussions or things that we've considered. What defines a space weapon? Is it something that is based in space? Is it something that is targeted at an object in space? And is it terrestrial based? So there's all these type of other ambiguities in that, which relate to the policies of how to regulate it, because how do you...
Right.
Yeah, how do you define
crazy.
A space weapon? Is it location?
That's
is it target?
The is you can't.
Right.
Exactly.
We don't have clear definitions.
So in terms of international regimes in space, the main legislation is what's known as the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. This was drafted through the United Nations during the space race between the U.S. and USSR. Essentially, it has three main provisions. Number one, which is most important, is that space is treated as, like, completely non-sovereign, right? It's open to all, free for all. It's like the sea, right? There is, you cannot have claim to any bodies in space, and, you know, attempting to have claim will just is futile, right? So the United States can't go claim the moon, and USSR can't go claim Jupiter or anything like that. Number two, which is really important, is you're not allowed to have nuclear weapons in space because we don't want, you know, nuclear orbital bombs, because that seems like a destabilizing to the nuclear regime that's on Earth. Number three is you can't test nuclear weapons in space because it's environmentally unsound and will probably screw up satellites. But so that's the framework that you're working in, is you have this outer space regime, and then companies are working in that, you know, framework and throughout that framework.
Right. And from those institutional and like legal precedents, we came up with, I mean, the world has come up with three main theories about whether or not to weaponize space. The first is this Wilsonian idealism that believes in international institutions' ability to regulate space. And it's very, very strongly against space weaponization because it will threaten the humanity, or not the humanity, the existence of humanity. The next is what some others call Marxist collectivism, which says that the international concerns, or the foreign policy, I guess, of countries is only temporary, and eventually we'll all become one human race, and that space at the end of the day is the common heritage of all mankind. So it's our responsibility to go out there,
right,
and either weaponize it or just colonize it. And then the last one, it's called Hobbesian realism, which, again, it's very, very cynical. It says that international relations are a state of continuous war and fear of war, and states have to, like, do everything in their power to become the most powerful nation on Earth, and then, in this case, outside of Earth. So space needs to be weaponized in order to become a great power on Earth and become the hegemon on Earth. So those are the three main ideas that, like, rule this argument. And we'll be delving a little bit more into, maybe not them specifically, but as we continue to speak about this, you'll hear how those theories translate into opinions.
Very snazzy, Franz. Megan, were you going to say something?
I guess so. So if we're just going to dive right into the conversation, we are reading one article right now, sort of like the prep that we all did. It's from a selected essay collection called Toward a Theory of Space Power. And in this collection, the question is raised, should the United States, you know, become a hegemony in space, and, you know, through that they can sort of create a Pax Americana again, where they can protect commercial interests in space, no one will have to worry traveling throughout space because it's not a war zone, America controls it all. And so they made the comparison to international waters, where America's naval dominance makes it safe for people to travel through the sea, for commercial vessels to travel through the sea, and everything is hunky-dory, and, you know, American hegemony is working out great there. And I'm just wondering, with the rise of China and their claims in the South China Sea, you know, America may be ceding some of its naval hegemony to China in those regions, and, you know, if it's not working out so well in the seas right now, you know, if there's already big power competition in the seas, which is an area that America had dominance in, how likely is it that America can establish itself as a hegemon in space with the context of, right, China and Russia questioning it where it's already dominant?
That's one question, is how likely. The other question is, like, is that something that we should pursue? Is that something we want? Like, should? Also, there's the question of feasibility. Like, is it physically possible to do such a thing? Which, you know, we'll talk about, but I personally think is insane. I'll say why in a couple minutes, but...
No, on that, I think that's a great point, because since basically the end of the Cold War, the United States has committed its naval forces to conduct, I guess, freedom of navigation, mm-hmm, exercises, where, as seeing in the South China Sea, they basically grab one of their Navy groups or carrier groups and just sail them straight through the South China Sea, even though China tells them, like, that it's theirs.
Yeah.
Just to ensure that it's freedom of navigation, and et cetera. So, like, it's interesting to think whether or not the United States would like to do it in space. Now, I do have a point of disagreement with you, and that is that I don't think China has been, I mean, it's not they're not in our level to challenging us in the South China Sea. Or
that's a conversation for a different day. I know, but I'm three different conversations.
I'm not saying necessarily that they can defeat us in the South China Sea, but I'm just saying that the situation where America peacefully administers all the seas and is all great, that's not true in all regions.
And I also think that's valid because the sea is going to be argued to be a more controlled, manageable environment. Space is completely different. I think comparing space arena to sea, deep sea, or other air, previous areas that the U.S. has tried to dominate or that we've looked to militarize, I think that's a very dangerous thing. I think space cannot be compared, even if you argue that if you have satellites that are controlling in lower Earth orbit, you can control the rest of space. I still think that it's way too vast, way too uncontrollable. And I don't think that looking at what the U.S. has done in those arenas is a good basis for saying then thus we can control space in a similar way.
So in terms of what they're actually proposing, like the thought process behind what would hegemony look like, or what would a space hegemon look like? Essentially, you literally have weapons in low Earth orbit protecting not only your satellites, but making sure that no other country could launch their own satellites. Like complete protection. Without permission from anyone, right? Like, you're literally just doing this. Like, this is the ultimate power move of power moves, is creating these set, you know.
This ultimate higher ground.
Exactly.
Call it.
And, yeah, the higher ground.
And you would have to, like, create such a system that is so vast. And also, it needs to remain secret, first of all, so that other states can start, you know, working on their own space weaponization programs. And then when you introduce it, or launch those, like, space weapons or whatever, it needs to be large enough to prevent any other state from doing so. So it's like basically you're talking about against the first strike capabilities of a country.
Right.
And it would translate into space weaponization in this case, because if you don't have like a vast enough system, then other countries would be able to easily create their own systems and create anarchy again in space.
And I also thinking looking long term, so let's say you are able to pull that off. Let's say you secretly maneuver and create the system, then you deploy it in outer space. Then who's just not to say that in a couple hundred, in a certain span of time, someone would figure out some future technology to then break that system and move on into other domination of extended space. I just think that arguing that that's where it's going to stop in lower Earth orbit and saying you've established hegemony over that region, I don't know if we can say for sure that that would be the be-all.
Oh, no, I mean, space is the eternal frontier, Molly.
Right, so it would continue forever. It's a never-ending...
And that's a story of humanity.
For weaponizing space. Yeah, so that's why starting it, I think, is a dangerous thing.
But, yes, it's a dangerous thing, but it's been the story of humanity since our start. With societies have started in small groups, and they've expanded to, like, almost empires, continental empires. And you see this movement of, like, entities and states on Earth.
In our first state of primary anarchy, as we call it.
Right. expanding and bringing more weaponization and control over large swaths of area, there's no reason not to believe that that's where history is heading towards, like,
if you're looking at the trends. Yeah. Right, so...
But we're talking about sort of, you know, humanity's history of anarchy, but we've done a lot to change that history. So we're asking, you know, what reason do we have to believe that we might not expand into space? I mean, we have the treaty. It hasn't happened yet. So, I mean, we can't say that definitively it will happen. We have to leave space for thinking that, you know, maybe humanity can police itself.
Right.
I also think in another reading that we did, a Mueller reading that talked about the taboo of space, it talks about the dangers of using human nature as a basis for continued weaponization. Because there are other weapons that we've created this kind of taboo around, with chemical weapons and bioweapons, and we're still working to try to increase that and, you know, diminish their presence. But to say that because human nature constantly seeks violence capabilities, I think is a dangerous or not a great path to follow. Also sets you up for terrible
violence. I agree with that. I think that at the same time, though, like, I don't classify space weapons in the same taboo area as chemical weapons and biological weapons, because those two weapons are meant to kill. They have no strategic advantage, they're just meant to kill. And since we have been constrained on Earth, given that we find technology that allows us to go break that frontier, I feel like humans will always break the frontier, because that's just being our nature, not our nature, like our trends as well, our historical trends, is always to push further, whether that's west to the Americas or globalization. It's all about pushing forward and organize and basically finding this homogeneous, not homogeneous, maybe just, you know, just pushing forward and like and expanding the frontiers.
Humans are curious, and if we develop the technology, we're going to want to use it. Yeah. To say that we're not going to employ it is unrealistic.
No, that's why I don't believe that it's going to be such a taboo thing, because it's not a means to kill people, although you can use it as for that. But like it's more as a means of expanding a frontier that's being unreachable.
And I think you're right to say that, you know, space weapons, you know, they don't necessarily have to be weapons for killing. They can just be space technology. We already benefit from satellites. And I think that's something to bring up that, you know, we're not just talking about weaponization. We could also be talking about technology. But how easy is it to say that this technology that is used to help people can't also be used as a weapon? You know, turn of the dime, America's, you know, foreign policy changes and we, you know, unleash this power to be, you know, in a negative way. And so with that, you know, nuclear technology, you know, a lot of countries are saying we want to develop our nuclear program to benefit ourselves, you know, for the advancement of our people, for energy, for whatever it is. And America doesn't take kindly to that in a lot of cases. And so
I would like to go back to our previous argument on the state of anarchy that humanity lives on, right? A lot of people, mainly
supposed state of anarchy.
Liberalists say that the only way to fix this is to form a world government.
Right.
Because right now, no state has the military capabilities. No state has the military
Bernie
capabilities.
Bernie Sanders advocates it.
Well, imagine that, though. Imagine Bernie Sanders, like, the 2020 campaign would be, space weaponization.
Nah, yeah. He doesn't want space weaponization. He definitely does not.
Nah, he doesn't seem like the kind of fella.
It's like space weaponization or giving money to students for college.
Space weaponization.
Yeah. So much a better idea.
Yeah. Bernie Sanders had, like, an identity crisis, comes out, new man. Anyways.
Yeah, no, but that's it.
Big tinfoil on his head, sorry.
And then, like, the little antenna coming out.
He becomes Vermin Supreme.
Sorry, Franz, what were you saying?
No worries. So since no state has the military capabilities of actually establishing a world government, one way is to develop such a technology that allows you to control Earth from space. And space weaponization and the ability to own space would give whoever country develops that technology a world hegemony in this state and would ensure peace. Or peace, you know, in quotation marks, or force kind of peace.
If hegemony could be achieved.
Well, yeah, that's true. And also, I mean, are we totally forgetting the fact that there is possibilities of cooperation between countries, right? Like, we can create a space regime or, you know, space international authority that will be able to defend things like the commercialization of space and satellites without having to have, you know, U.S. hegemony of space or Chinese hegemony of space or something crazy like that.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Whose goal is it that you're trying to protect? Are we trying to protect specific countries? Are we trying to protect the human species and ensure the best possibilities of living for everyone? Because, yes, I think space, if it were operated from some international organization, not that, again, we have one to necessarily start from in terms of entering space, but I think they would best, organize it so that everyone could benefit from it. And also, I don't know if we want to delve into this right now, but I think this relates to asteroids.
Oh my gosh. Threats,
but that, I don't know if we want to open that can of worms. We can talk about this.
We'll see.
Okay.
No, yeah, like, personally, asteroids. I'm very wary of international organizations because
too,
I keep getting disappointed by them. For example, Syria, again, gassed its own people a week ago. And the Security Council met. Nikki Haley did a great job telling the Russians that they have no humanity. And then the Russians vetoed any resolution, even though it's very, very likely that the Syrian government did gas their own people.
Well, you're speaking too soon, my friend. I mean, we've yet to have an international response because we're still determining whether or not. I mean, like, they're still getting blood samples. They're still going to the site and having investigations. It's not.
Even still.
I mean, it's a bureaucracy. It doesn't happen like lickety
even
split.
Even still, in 7 years, the Syrians have 700,000 Syrians have died in that conflict, and the Russians refuse to let any international form of resolution pass.
Right.
And
so there's a problem with international, but is that intrinsic in all cooperation internationally, or is that a problem of the United Nations that we have now, in which their lack of action corresponds to the United Nations Security Council and FIDOs.
I think that when you have differing national interests, you will never get coverage.
But I think there has been some success. I mean, the Non-Proliferation Treaty is a generally successful example of...
We're talking about space, the outer space regime.
Right, or the outer space treaty of 1967. I mean, Zach went over it before. It set pretty good precedence. I mean, states abandoning their ASAT programs and satellite, that was kind of an unprecedented step, and we've never seen that before. So I don't think the groundwork is not there for international space cooperation. And I also think it's a unique frontier that truly can really benefit everyone, and if everyone recognizes that, that could have long-lasting positive effects.
Right. From, I think, a more sociological perspective, I think if we're talking about the economic uses of space, you're going to run into transnational corporations and states who want to benefit from that more than other states. You know, they don't want to cut the pie equally. They want to grow the pie and then take the biggest bite out of the pie. And I think we've seen that even through, you know, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund.
Right.
A lot of those organizations are controlled, you know, majority stake by the United States. So it's not necessarily, you know, a hegemony, but it is, you know, the United States controls most of it. You're not seeing Bolivia making these moves in the IMF, dominating the system. No, you don't. And
it's
so
an
oligopoly,
and we're the monopoly man.
Really. And so I think if we extended that model into space, saying that we have a new space authority that's going to determine which companies or which countries get which stakes in space, you know, which country is going to get the most lucrative slice of the pie.
So maybe
it's going to be America or China or Russia, the big guys.
That's why I believe that I'm very worried of international cooperation in this area, because I just don't think that Russia and China are going to sit there and let the United States create another international organization that mainly benefits the U.S. And when that doesn't happen, the U.S. is going to say, like, I don't want to do this anymore.
I think we're just not there yet, right? Like, yeah. I mean, it's 2018. First of all, we don't have the technology to create an international space authority, and we don't really have a need to yet. Like, we do not have the technology to harvest minerals of asteroids. I mean, in theory we do, and there are companies that are pursuing such a thing, but feasibility-wise, it's not there. We can start working on things like that, but it's going to take many decades. Yeah. We're talking about this now because in order to create proper framework for the future, you have to talk about it now, right? So I think talking about current political crises causing the downsides of international organizations might be irrelevant in 50 years, in which, you know, maybe we're all happy and can cooperate, hopefully.
I agree. I think there's definitely progress that can be made.
Yes. And just getting a little bit more into the political theory side of it, I think that any progress that could, you know, possibly be made in space would has to be related to the, I guess, liberalization of China and Russia. Because I honestly think that's the main source of friction, is that those two governments are indeed authoritarian regimes. Don't function the same way as Europe.
Russian listeners might be a little bit...
I mean, it's...
Right.
Yeah, like...
Depends who you talk to, yes.
I mean, Putin ran against no one.
No one.
And Xi Jinping is dictator for
literally life. Just eliminated constitutional term limits.
Yeah, so like, as long as these states are authoritarian regimes, I just don't see how cooperation can be effective and long-lasting, because I think authoritarian regimes are a lot more willing to be revisionists.
Right, so is your argument, because international organizations don't work properly, the only way we can ensure safe use of space fairly is by having a benign hegemon, i.e. the United States? And, like, we just trust the U.S. to be good for the rest of time, and that's it. And we're just, hoping that countries accept this? Or?
No, my argument is that in order to have international organizations that work properly, the states in that organization have to have some sort of unifying political idea, whether that is authoritarianism or democracy, probably democracy, because that, you know, leads to consensus, theoretically. So that's my argument, that in order to have an international organization that functions well, you have to have some degree of democratic thought in all of the countries involved.
But, all right, Franz, right now, you're on Trump's National Space Advisory Board, and he's like, yo, do we militarize space or not? What's your answer?
My answer would be, let's see what technology is available to us. Let's see how well we can mass produce this technology, and let's
see
how
we make the best satellites, the biggest satellites,
the biggest satellites, the biggest space weapons,
the best space deal in the history of space deals.
Yeah, no, I would look at the technology that we have, at our ability to keep it secret,
right,
and our ability to mass produce it.
All right, Molly, you are the advisor to President Trump. He is talking about space. God. What is your answer? Do we militarize space?
I mean, I say no. I think the fact that there hasn't been decisive leadership on the issue, and there's been a lot of hesitance from policy leaders in the past, probably is, with from people that know a lot more about the technicalities of it than I do, I think is probably a good sign that it's a really dangerous thing, should be thought about a lot more in depth. But I agree with Franz that I don't think research or development should be halted. I do think the U.S. should not go about it alone or necessarily covertly. If they were to be caught or found out, that would just beget other states rapidly accelerating their own programs.
Yeah.
Can the U.S. afford to be the second country to enter space? I'm not sure. I feel like probably just given raw capabilities, the U.S. could probably handle that in comparison to Russia or China. Personally, I'd be willing to take that risk as a young millennial.
But Molly, if China militarizes space, it's all on you now.
Hypothetical. All right, I'll take that burden. The United States manages to weaponize space and become the only person who does it. Now, do they prevent Russia or China or the European Union from also weaponizing their own space by, let's say, drawing a red line on the sand saying, like, no, this is our space now?
Well, at that point, they have to. If you are weaponizing space and you're under the assumption that, like, we're not going to be hegemons, you're just creating this insane international, like, competition that is just going to lead to another nuclear arms race to an even higher extent at greater stakes, right? Because, first of all, the thing about space is there's no defense, right? It's just like nuclear weapons again. It's like mutually assured destruction. If you put up a space weapon, it's really easy to shoot down. That's half the problem is right now, if like NASA launches some literal marbles into space at the correct trajectory, it can just destroy, you know, $1 trillion space weapon that you place, you know, in a second at a low cost. So that's half the problem is it'll create this incredible arms race. And then the other half of the problem is there's no, like, we're operating under the assumption that we respond in the same currency, right? If the United States puts up a satellite and space weapon, and then we shoot down, you know, China's space weapon, that's operating on the assumption that China won't take conventional measures against the U.S. on Earth, which is crazy. If we destroy Chinese capabilities to militarize space, they're just going to launch an attack on us or nuke us or something like that.
You could argue that, though, by then, if we have this hegemony in space, our capabilities of inflicting violence on them are much higher.
Actually,
so they wouldn't want to retaliate.
Well, right. Remember that China's military capabilities also rely, we talked about this in the beginning of the podcast, they rely on their satellites. So
right.
If we have a hegemony over space, we have a hegemony over Earth.
Right.
Or like, I mean, I'm saying we in like very general terms, but like whoever has that hegemony has also the hegemony over Earth.
But I think that's also, yes, okay, so space is this high ground where if you are able to control it, you have these intense capabilities because you have visibility, you have, just ability to control the general Earth, but I just think that it's too unpredictable, and the idea that space is much easier to disrupt than it is to control. And a lot of this is based on hypotheticals that
right.
we don't know, and I think
right.
that it's just not a secure foundation to say that the U.S. could feasibly and sustainably control.
Right.
It would take a lot of money.
The can part is unknown.
Right.
So, in my humble opinion, from the perspective of a freshman undergraduate student who has read a total of one article on the topic.
Megan, don't reveal everything.
All right. I guess I've talked a lot about, like, capitalism and transnational interests in space and, you know, whether or not it would be distributed equally. But, like, my personal thoughts are that the United States cannot miss the chance to become the hegemon in space.
Yeah.
So if we even get the sense that China or Russia or anyone else is thinking about expanding into space, we have to beat them
mm-hmm.
to it. And I think some of that is in developing our own programs low-key, covertly, and maybe not focus on weapons, but focus on, you know, what technologies could, you know, really benefit the living standard of the American people from space. Focus on that, just getting, you know, our feet wet in space.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we get a whiff of competition from other countries, you know, we'd have to go for it, but we'd have to wait, and I don't want to spark that. So keeping it as low-key as possible. And then I think that
But so wait, I just want to clarify. So you're saying timing is all relative. We should begin our space weaponization in action relative to other countries' timeline and don't initiate unless other countries begin.
So I'm saying start some really benign research right now. How do we float something in space? How do we,
service satellites? Stuff
how
like
do
that.
We project something from another?
How do you project something? Yeah. How do you just move this up?
So, I know other countries won't see that kindly, which is why we should keep it a little bit of a secret. And then if they do find out, we'll keep it super benign.
Yeah.
And
I'm from that, though.
Investigating how to brush your teeth in space.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we do actually need to learn from...
We don't want to be caught with our pants down.
Exactly. And we need to learn from our mistake in 1949 to just allow the Russians to have a nuclear weapon.
Franz. What? We're going to invade them? What were we going to do to the
USSR? I think Cold War mentalities are not today's mentalities.
I would disagree with that. That's for another podcast. But we need to learn from... we had world hegemony, quote-unquote, for 4 years because we were the only nation with the technology to have nuclear weapons. When we lost that hegemony, the Cold War really started because now, mutually assured destruction meant that we had to divide the world between communists and capitalists, etc. Now, going to space exploration, I think that if we do get to space first, if we do weaponize space first, we're going to have to do everything in our power to keep other states from doing so as well.
Zach, what are your thoughts? We've all sort of opined here.
Oh, man. Well, so... I believe I come from a very, maybe optimistic, maybe naive is the better word, but definitely optimistic background of cooperation works, and the only reason why cooperation doesn't work is because we think it doesn't work. That's my mindset. So I think...
A true constructivist?
A true constructivist at the core. What I think is probably likely to happen is... Right now, it seems like governments don't care a lot about space. I mean, you have Trump having rhetoric, like he literally went in front of the Marines and said, let's have a space force, but I mean...
Star Wars.
Right. Yeah.
We're going to get to that later.
SDI's coming, but so anyways, I don't think governments are currently pursuing active space technology because it's just not feasible right now. We know for a fact that it's easy to shoot down space weapons. We know that if they shoot down a satellite, we can just shoot down another satellite of theirs. It's like this, weird deterrence playing. Right, so I don't think right now it's a problem. But I think when technology continues to develop, we have private companies right now lowering the cost of going into space. We have private companies looking into mining asteroids. When all of these things develop, it's going to become a much bigger problem, which is why we have to deal with it now. And I think that's the key, is right now it's not competitive, right? There's no reason for any of these governments to want to be in space. I mean, there is a reason, but it's not feasible. And so it's not this high-intensity competition. It's like Antarctica, right? We were able to create an effective treaty in Antarctica because no one had any military uses for it. No one really wanted it at, 1954, whatever, when we created the Antarctic Treaty. So if we create an Antarctic Treaty for space now, which is stronger than just the current Outer Space Treaty, which says, here's the rules of the road for space. You can't have anti-satellite weapons. We define what an anti-satellite weapon is. You can't have... space weaponization, we define what space weaponization is. All this takes ridiculous amounts of diplomacy, but through cooperation it can be done. If we do all those things now and we create some governing authority with actual teeth, which will probably just be joint interest in everyone wants to use space, then I think if we do that now when the stakes are low, later when the stakes are high, we'll be better off.
Although, I mean, you mentioned the Atlantic Treaty. Oh, not Atlantic Treaty, Antarctic Treaty. That's coming to an end in a couple of years. And right. There's no way that's going to be get ratified again.
Hey, we'll see.
After they found natural gas and like oil under it.
Right. Yeah. France.
So
it works on a slow stakes. When it's high stakes.
Yeah. So that's. I think like,
it will be tested. It will be tested. I'm not saying what will happen. It will be tested.
All of my everything I've said is just because I want to be Ender Wiggin and just shoot people in a space station and be a space commander.
Oh, wait, can we now moving on to we mentioned the Star Wars system that Reagan floated. Would that be considered a space weapon?
Absolutely. That was the whole
point. The ability to shoot down a missile from Earth, would that be considered a space weapon?
That is a space weapon.
By multiple definitions, I would say.
All right.
I don't know. Also, the problem with SDI is it didn't work.
What's SDI?
Strategic Defense Initiative. Sorry. That was Reagan's Star Wars. That's, you'll have these realists who essentially say, half the reason why the Soviet Union collapsed is because they knew the United States had this ridiculously strong technological advantage, which was shown through the Strategic Defense Initiative, which essentially was our...
A bluff.
A total bluff. And it didn't work because... there was no way we could feasibly do it in 1990. There's no way you can feasibly do it now. It's like, yeah, the technology just isn't there to be able to shoot other countries' satellites also, and ICBMs out of space.
We can't even do it on Earth.
Right. Like, we can't do it on Earth. Like the, you know, THAAD works like
that. But so that's it. If we get the technology to do it, should the United States immediately put it up to use in space and not allow other countries to?
No, you do it cooperatively, everything together, as Daniel Dooley says.
Zach, if you have the ability to become a global hegemon, why would you give up that?
Because it's not feasible. China and Russia won't let it happen. They just,
right. But their capabilities would be nullified since we have this like grand technology that would
take away their strength. I'm not convinced that we could establish it. Molly, you're gonna...
That's also, I just think it's assuming that Russia and China and those state actors would be the primary threats. I think it's worth acknowledging that in this non-post-Cold War mentality and world in which we live, kind of to what Zach was saying about international cooperation, threats can come from non-state actors and what would be the potential of if, like, a rogue space attack. Okay, granted, space access and
the
that
barriers to entry, yes, are very high.
The barriers to entry are really, really high for space civilization.
Elon Musk turns evil.
Yeah, sure.
Elon Musk versus the world.
Elon Musk and Bernie Sanders, hat. They get together matching tinfoil, right? Hats.
Oh, God. That's that would be terrifying. But what if a single rogue type attack happened in space? I guess, sure, a terrorist organization harnessing space capabilities seems incredibly ridiculous because of the expenses. However, what if that were to potentially be a threat? I think that cooperation would be the only effective way to really, really address that.
So, I guess... I can get a little bit into this right now. So I think I wouldn't call what we have right now like Cold War mentality, but I would call it great power politics, which is the same thing that we had in the Cold War. The Cold War was a bipolar great power politics situation. Mm-hmm. Now we have a multipolar great power politics situation, and the and the international system works the same way. Cooperation is hard to find because we have different ideals and different national interests. And that said, we should do anything in our power to secure those national interests, even if it means pissing off other great powers.
Franz, a realist at heart.
Yeah, I guess I just got that Wilsonian idea that any type of weaponry as a precedent, as a basis, is just going to beget more weapons. It's just going, right, to encourage violence.
Right.
So why would you take that step?
If we have a realist, a Wilsonian, a constructivist, and we have a burgeoning sociologist realist. I'm figuring it out.
An enthusiast of tinfoil hats.
I'm fine. Any effort to be collectivist. Hey guys,
do you guys want to take a quick break, get some tinfoil, and put it around their heads?
Oh, honestly, I'm down. Have you guys seen the tinfoil, the balls they make out of it? You get a huge sheet of tinfoil, scrunch it up,
and hang around
in the ball. And they make them smooth?
Yes, they make them smooth.
I don't believe that. I don't think that's real.
No, it's real. That's smack it with a hammer. It's legit.
Yeah, because you make it dense.
Tinfoil hats.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
I brought us all some tinfoil hats. They're not that good. You know, I just kind of, my hands.
Beautiful,
right, well, our next picture outside Gilman will be us in tinfoil hats. So
stay tuned.
I feel like that should be the... our primary way of getting people to watch this, just pass flyers.
They would think we're so cool.
Listen to our podcast.
Yeah. Oh, we promise we're not crazy.
We're just a little bit crazy.
All right, so space out, everybody.
Space out.
Anyways, thank you for listening to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Casual conversation, episode one.
Yeah, follow us in the coming weeks. We should be coming out with a couple more podcasts with professors. Hopefully,
Professor Schmidt.
We're pretty sure that he will be able to do one.
Hopefully.
And then we also contacted Professor Dudney, which, yes, I know, which he's the main professor on campus that speaks about nuclear weapons and space weaponization and biological weapons as well. So we will have a continuation of this podcast with him probably.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you, Molly.
Thank you so much, Molly.
Also, follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, everything you can follow us on.
But not real life.
Or you can follow us in real life.
You know, I would...
at Hopkins POFA.
I would be completely okay if you guys follow us in real life.
Yeah, honestly,
we need a posse. We need a posse.
Oh, some groupies.
In a tinfoil hat and
you're
we'll
one of us.
Be on the next podcast. All right. Goodbye. Have a lovely month.
Bye-bye.